ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just a warning that there are some graphic descriptions of violence in this episode, so take care listening. It's February 11, 1990, a week since South Africa's president F.W. de Klerk lifted the ban on the African National Congress. And the whole world is waiting for Nelson Mandela to be released from prison. South Africans call him by his clan name, a term of respect and affection, Madiba, our hero. Finally, word comes.
The apartheid state had said they're releasing Mandela the next morning, and we were completely not organized.
Everyone's caught off guard by the short notice, including Jay Naidoo. He's Secretary General of the Congress of South African Trade Unions at the time.
And I arrived the next morning at the prison gate, and it's the first time I've voluntarily gone to a prison. And so we get taken to the house where Madiba is living. And I hear his voice like, "Hello, comrades, welcome."
Madiba's been in prison for 27 years. No one's seen his face in all this time, let alone heard his deep, booming voice.
Of course, we don't know what to expect. Never seen him. Then he walks up, like, incredibly tall, regal Mandela. It's like a grandfather walking up, you know? He embraces us, and then we sit and we have tea. And so, yeah, we sat for hours. The whole world was waiting for him to walk out of the prison, but there he was making sure people had tea and biscuits.
After a few hours, he's ready. The world's most famous political prisoner is about to walk free. But there's no plan. No security. It's ludicrous. Mandela's beloved by the movement, but he's enemy number one for many Afrikaners. This could turn dangerous really fast.
The security police dropped him on our laps. And so I became the security person in the car in front.
The world watches as Madiba drives away from the prison, Jay Naidoo leading the convoy.
Everywhere we went, there was thousands of people all along the highways. And we arrived at the center of town, and the car literally has been squashed by the pressure of people.
Wow.
There was complete joy. I've never seen joy like that, but it was dangerous.
Mandela's driver panics, and he just takes off, away from the crushing crowd.
We lost Mandela for a while, for an hour.
Oh, wow, you physically did not know where he was. That's very scary.
He randomly drives through suburban streets, unsure what to do, and he stops outside a stranger's house.
When the people came out to see him, it was an Afrikaner couple, and he went in and had tea with them. And it was a set of twins and their parents until we found him again. And we brought him back so they could make his speech.
That's amazing.
And then he addressed the people.
One of the most significant days in history. And Nelson Mandela's lost in the suburbs, having a cup of tea with an Afrikaner family. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and this is the final episode of our ABC Rewind series, Boycott, the Fight to End Apartheid. Episode 6, Homecoming. We began this series with 16-year-old me sitting in front of the TV on my auntie's couch in Nairobi, watching Nelson Mandela walk out of prison a free man, hand in hand with Winnie, oblivious to all that behind-the-scenes drama. I'm full to the brim with hopes and dreams, just so, so happy.
Who among us didn't watch it and weep, weep? I can barely talk about it without crying because it was everything.
There was only one song, only Nelson Mandela, Sabela, Huyabisa, Sabela, Huyabisa. Nelson Mandela, yo, what emotions. people all over were celebrating the level of hope.
You know, it's difficult to describe the joy just sent all of us wild with excitement.
Now is the time to intensify the struggle.
My dad's name is Mavusom Simang, but we call him Baba. And when Mandela's released, he's still in exile. He's also watching from his home in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
I mean, we kept our eyes glued on the television set. You couldn't help but hold back tears. I'm gripped by that now as I talk to you.
Same here.
So it was an amazing moment, and it was victory.
We're all on the phone to each other, rejoicing. And I picture telephone lines lighting up homes all around the world as South Africans everywhere connect through this great big spider web of joy. Baba left South Africa in 1963, and he's been waiting so long for this moment, longing for the day he can go home. He's been gone as long as Madiba's been locked up, 27 years.
We just thought we are going to get back home, but the truth is that you didn't know when it would happen. Yeah. Everybody wanted to go home almost immediately.
But they don't. There's still too much doubt, too much uncertainty. So my parents hold back, waiting to see what will happen next. This strange limbo between Mandela's release in 1990 and the end of apartheid is incredibly violent. No one trusts anyone. There are mass killings and peace talks that keep falling apart. Moments when it seems South Africa will plunge into civil war. Terror hums just below the surface, and the past hangs heavy in our bones as we hurtle towards an uncertain future. There's an entire system to dismantle. There are wounds to heal. There's so much work to be done. Where on earth do we begin? What will the new South Africa look like? Zwelinzima Vavi is, well, he's Vavi.
And is there a title, an official title you'd like us to use as well?
Comrade.
Vavi is such a character, a joker. But he grew up in poverty, politicized by the injustice he saw as a kid. He starts working in the mines as a young man, becomes a union leader. He's jailed many, many times. And he remembers living in Sharpeville, where that awful massacre took place in 1960. Dreaming about the houses he might live in one day.
I used to point to the house that I'm going to confiscate. So when we defeat these guys, that's going to be my house. So we had all of those type of dreams. And the reality of the fact that we didn't defeat them meant that you need to find a settlement and that you need to explain the settlement to the rest of the membership and to the people as a whole. It was not an easy thing, very, very difficult. And it was the moment of very, very painful confrontation.
By now, Vavi's not a fresh-faced kid who thinks he can just move into a white person's house. He's in the leadership team of one of the most powerful unions in the country. The boycotts and sanctions have gotten us this far, but Black people haven't won yet. A peaceful transition still has to be negotiated, and not everyone likes that. In May 1990, the ANC and the de Klerk government meet for the first time and agree to start talks about talks. Afrikaner nationalists are livid.
Responding to the latest reforms, an extreme right-wing group has warned that Boers will take up arms before allowing apartheid to be scrapped. Con Stuckey is a senior commandant and financial secretary of the Afrikaner Resistance Movement, a group which displays a stylized swastika emblem and wears brown shirt uniforms. Mr. Stuckey told Jane Rowe that Mr. de Klerk and his government are traitors to their race.
What they're doing here now is taking away everything that belongs to the white and what we've worked for and established by our own intellect, just hand over to a black government. We are going to resist, that is for sure.
Is the Afrikaner resistance movement armed?
No response. No comment.
The Afrikaner resistance movement, the AWB, is a paramilitary ultra-right wing group formed in 1973. The AWB wants a white-only state. Even apartheid wasn't racist enough for them. So, it comes out fighting against the negotiations, marching in Nazi uniforms with those horrible dogs trained to attack black people. And it's terrifying.
What's wrong with the idea of allowing blacks and whites to live alongside each other?
I'm trying to explain to you people that these people aren't fully civilized.
It's not just white violence that's flaring. There's also increasing violence in black communities. In the last episode, we talked a lot about the Inkatha Freedom Party, the Zulu group that's very anti-Mandela and the ANC, and not so secretly funded by the apartheid regime.
People are dying like flies. I happen to have been one of the first people to witness the death of an old aged lady in the streets of Sebokeng when the marauding gangs of IFP marched into the township and they attacked and killed the woman. That was to be the start of violence. And we saw these people were killed in the trains, in the funerals, in the hostels. Wow.
So the country is tense. And you'll hear much more about that later. But I often think about what it must have been like for Nelson Mandela to step out of prison and into this vortex. It would have been hard enough simply adjusting to life on the outside, let alone having to deal with all of this. It's a lot. But just 8 days after he's released, Mandela's issued his first South African passport, and he heads off on a thank you tour of African nations. It's epic. Madiba and Winnie stop in Nairobi, where I'm at school, and this is my moment. A small group of exiles is invited to meet them, and 16-year-old me is one of them. I bring flowers for Winnie, and oh my God, I am beaming. A child of the struggle, finally meeting the mother and father of our revolution. Next up, it's a whistle-stop tour of Europe, including Ireland, where he meets the grapefruit ladies who refuse to sell South African produce. Then America, where Mandela's greeted like a rock star. Barbara Masakela is there.
It was just crazy, the way he was able, in the United States of all countries, to speak about Cuba, to speak about Libya, to speak about Palestine. It was just amazing. You know, he was enjoying his role, you know.
And he was enjoying his freedom.
You know, I mean, when I think of the old man, that's how I think of him. As somebody who is having so much fun.
I love this.
You know, finally being able to say the things he had been thinking, that he had been prevented from saying. You just realized you were in the presence of a noble and rare human being.
After this trip, Barbara Masakela becomes Mandela's chief of staff, helping him navigate the tricky transition from prisoner to president. Finally, it's Australia's turn, and Nelson Mandela thanks an awestruck crowd of 40,000 people from the iconic steps of the Opera House.
Comrades, our visit here is a fulfillment of a long-standing wish to come and thank you personally for the marvelous contribution you have made to our freedom struggle. Even within the thick prison walls of Robben Island, the steadfastness of your solidarity filtered through.
All shall be equal before the law. Freedom, child!
for all those Australians who fought the good fight, who protested the Springbok rugby tour in 1971, who picketed businesses supporting South Africa, who put their blood, sweat, and tears into helping bring down apartheid. It's a moment. And then, while Mandela's in Sydney, he makes a special visit. This is Unionist Joe Deakin, who helped initiate the oil embargo.
Yeah, he'd come here, and he was greeted by the union. And in fact, I think the photo of Pat Garrity with Nelson Mandela, I think it was taken in the rooms here. They're shaking hands with one another, and they're laughing. And it's the pride and joy of this union rooms here, because Nelson Mandela made a special mention after being imprisoned. He personally thanked the Seamen's Union of Australia and the Waterside Workers' Federation for the great contribution in dismantling apartheid through the oil embargo.
But after this euphoric world tour, it's back down to earth as Nelson Mandela heads home to deal with escalating tensions. Pressure is building within the ANC about how much to compromise. Not everyone trusts the de Klerk government to negotiate in good faith, including Mandela's beloved wife, Winnie. It's Winnie who's been on the street fighting injustice while her husband was in jail, and it's radicalized her, which means things have turned a little frosty between her and Nelson since that beautiful day they walked out of prison holding hands. Their differences are both personal and political. There are salacious rumors about Winnie's infidelity. And then there's this.
The South African government is to charge Winnie Mandela with kidnapping and assault.
The affair involves the so-called Mandela United Football Club, who operated as bodyguards for Mrs. Mandela in the volatile township while her husband was still in jail. They exercised an awesome power. 14-year-old Stompie Moeketsi, who'd been accused of being a police informer, and three other youths were abducted by members of the club and taken to Mrs. Mandela's former home.
I welcome the decision in the sense that at last I will be able to stand a proper trial and clear my name properly. Up to now, I have been tried and found guilty by the media in South Africa.
The government's decision to formally charge her will heighten already strained relations with the ANC.
As a gesture of good faith, President de Klerk says he'll grant indemnity to ANC comrades in exile if MK, Mkhonto weSizwe, stops its armed struggle. Mandela agrees, but the head of MK, the dynamic Chris Hani, isn't consulted, and he's not happy. He reluctantly follows the party line, though, and gets on board, suspending all military activities. And before long, former MK fighters start flooding back to South Africa. Valanga Khoza is one of them. He's one of the student activists you heard from earlier in the series who left after the Soweto uprisings in 1976 to join MK.
I said to my sister, when we get to Nkowankowa, can you please don't let anyone know that I'm back? I just want to see my family. I want to see my mother alone. I want to keep it quiet.
But it's not to be.
As soon as we pull into Nkowankowa Township, I see cars everywhere. Beep, 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 beep. You know, and we arrive at my mother's house. There were hundreds of people.
To greet you.
To come and welcome me. And I'm looking everywhere. I'm overwhelmed. I'm in tears. Some of them come and, Falanga, don't you remember me? And I realize that son of the soil is back and all that.
That's exactly the word that was on my mouth, son of the soil.
Yeah. And then you realize that, hey, you belong to yourself, you belong to your mother, but you belong to the people. You belong to everyone. You know, the struggle is for everyone. So forget about wishing for that private moment. Yeah.
Wow.
And suddenly I look and I see my mother, whom I hadn't seen for a very, very long time. And she's walking towards me.
There are emotional scenes like this all across South Africa. So many long overdue reunions. And also, on those first visits home, many of us get our hands on something really special.
I managed for the first time in my life to get an identification, a passport with my name, with my own photo.
Wow. I remember doing the same thing at Shell House as well.
Whew.
And then we came back a few days later and we had this green passport.
Yeah.
It didn't have your race.
Yeah. Suddenly the race thing is gone.
Not long after Valanga, it's my turn to go home. When I step off that plane in Johannesburg and touch South African soil for the first time, it's surreal. I've imagined this day my whole life. I head into Joburg with its glittering lights and fast cars and check into the Holiday Inn. Then I go out to dinner with my cousins and a white waitress serves us. Ha, imagine that. As we sit on the pavement on this beautiful summer's evening, a homeless black man is singing Nat King Cole, and he's good. But the waitress shoos him away with an unmistakable ode to racism. She is not ready for us. We are on our feet in a flash, in her face, telling her not to talk to black people like that. We aim our long, pent-up rage squarely at her. This is our country, too. And we're back, baby! Ha, 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 ha. Then, finally, it's Baba's turn to come home. He was only 21 when he left South Africa. And now, at 51, he heads straight to his mother's house in KwaZulu.
When I got into that house, I just broke down completely, you know.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. That was hard. Then I said to myself, I'm home now.
Wow, that's making me emotional.
Yeah, it was tough. And things had changed. A fair bit, but I mean, it was really nice to meet my mother again.
But yes, as Baba says, things have changed a fair bit. South Africa is a battleground. Right-wing racists are marching up and down the streets in full Nazi regalia. And Inkatha's ramping up its killing of ANC supporters.
So of course, when you guys come back, South Africa was in blood and flames. I mean, you guys were in Natal. There was so much violence and conflict.
And the hostels in Johannesburg, where mostly Zulu people work, were just places of serious and indescribable cruel conflict, where the government was still, you know, behind the scenes, encouraging this hostel dwellers who were mostly affiliated to Buthelezi's party, the Inkatha Freedom Party, who saw himself really being upstaged by the ANC. The ANC was being invited to the negotiating tables. That unleashed so much conflict in KwaZulu-Natal. And when it is said that there was a smooth transition democracy, it's true only to the extent that white people and black people did not fight. But within the black community, there was serious loss of life. I haven't looked at the figures. It can't have been less than 60,000 or so people were killed in those conflicts.
In June 1991, the government formally repeals apartheid legislation. And that brings South Africa one step closer to its first official talks about the transition to democracy. But then, another setback. Security forces raid the home of an ANC member and find evidence of a top-secret military operation. Remember MK leader Chris Hani's pledge to put the guns down? Well, the movement hasn't quite done that. It's kept a mission called Operation Vula alive, smuggling in guns as an insurance policy against the violence. The government's livid and accuses the ANC of bad faith negotiations. The ANC accuses them of the same. After all, it's pretty widely known
that the government's funding the Inkatha Freedom Party. It started doing this in the 1980s to destabilize the Black community, to keep us divided. And now it's doing it to weaken the ANC's negotiating power and to convince the world that Black people are too violent to be trusted to run the country. So, if the government's going to talk peace by day and attack the ANC through Inkatha by night, then the ANC can play that game too. And this is just how it will be over the next few years of this transition period, walking this tightrope, always playing this precarious game of brinkmanship, one step forward, three steps back. As this violence within the Black community continues, Winnie faces trial for her part in the kidnapping and beating of young Black men in Soweto. And she's found guilty.
Guilty but still defiant, Winnie Mandela, buoyed up by the cheers of supporters as she and Nelson Mandela left court tonight to face the waiting before she's sentenced. But Nelson Mandela knows well the damage to his family name. He'd pressed for this trial, hoping his wife would be cleared.
Mandela's navigating these complex negotiations with the regime and responding to endless carnage on the streets. But he sits in court, stoic, in a suit, supporting his wife to the end. It's heartbreaking to watch, and the media laps it up.
As the Mandelas push through the crowds to get home tonight, Nelson Mandela faces all the new strains of his wife's conviction to add to the real anguish he feels at the township slaughter and the damaged negotiations with President de Klerk.
Winnie's sentenced to 6 years in jail, but she appeals. And a year later, her kidnapping charge is overturned and her punishment is reduced to a 2-year suspended sentence. But for now, confidants are telling Madiba to leave her, that this is a moment for cool heads, that Winnie's too fiery. She's a liability, the shadow to his light. But Madiba stands by his woman, for now. In December 1991, official talks finally begin. The goal is a new constitution to nut out what the core values of a new South Africa should be. The stakes are high for everyone. Black people really want their land back, but white people are worried they'll lose their farms and their homes. Big business worries that mines, farms, and factories will be nationalized. And even within the movement, there's chatter about those ANC leaders back from exile. They sure like their suits and their whiskey. Can they be trusted? It's precarious. But at the end of those first talks, everyone agrees. The goal is a non-racial, democratic state. Sounds so simple now, but it's a huge step forward. But, and of course there's always a but, those far-right racist groups like the AWB, they keep insisting that President de Klerk has no right to make these changes, that he has no mandate. And I hate to say this, but they're kind of right. De Klerk will never be able to say he represents the will of white people unless he tests the idea. So in March 1992, with Mandela's support, he holds a referendum. There's a catch, though. Only white people can vote. Fiery teenage me is appalled that we're asking white people's permission to end apartheid. But thankfully, I'm not in charge. Because what Mandela's doing here is taking a well-calculated risk. He knows that any future ANC government will need this mandate too. And he's betting on most white South Africans knowing they can't turn back. But tension explodes on referendum day.
The maelstrom of politics reached boiling point on this judgment day. The country's defence forces are virtually on a war footing as they try to keep a lid on the violence. Terrorists, black and white, are making the most of this country's confusion. In Soweto, a black woman is shot. Her neighbours accuse the army. Police move in, ordering this army unit to back off. This is the tension of South Africa this week.
But Mandela's gamble pays off. 68% of white people vote yes. The month after the referendum, the mother and father of our nation sit the kids down for a talk.
In view of the tensions that have arisen owing to differences between ourselves, we have mutually agreed that a separation would be best for each one of us.
After 34 years of marriage, Winnie and Nelson Mandela are separating. It's all just become too much. Thankfully, my own parents are still very much in love, and they move back to South Africa for good. My middle sister's at school in Ethiopia, and I'm at uni in America. After years of moving around in exile, Zambia, Kenya, Canada, Ethiopia, finally, we have a family home in South Africa. But for Baba, everything's different now. Parks and pools and beaches and cinemas and shops, they're no longer segregated. And there's a jostling for power on the streets. People don't know how to just be.
The government had persuaded the majority of the white people that have no fear, you make sure that your interests are protected. And a lot of white people were coming on side, were accepting that fact. There was nevertheless quite a number of white people who walked about carrying guns. That was quite ugly, frightening, but really more than anything, it said there isn't peace here. I think there has been so much said about how bad black people were, and there had been so much cruelty meted out to them. There were fears that there would be revenge. ANC in Council of Churches, Desmond Tutu, preaching peace and the banishment of revenge really guided that transition. But the tensions were there.
I worry so much about my family during this time. Like a lot. And I call them every week from a phone box near my dorm. And it's strange. We expected the threats from the right-wing Afrikaners. But it's the Inkatha attacks that feel like a punch in the gut. Especially this one. In June 1992, Inkatha kills 45 people in one night in a township called Boy Patong.
Even the most hardened veterans of township violence were horrified as the dimensions of last night's massacre became known. People slaughtered in their homes, hacked to death in their beds, shot as they tried to escape. Among the victims, a 9-month-old baby. It was the worst incident of its kind in 2 years. There were men in police vehicles directing the attackers, he says.
After Boy Patong, the ANC's fed up with the government playing nice at the talks by day, but supplying Inkatha with weapons to kill by night. It's tired of them sowing all this clandestine chaos to force concessions. Furious, the ANC pulls out of the latest round of talks.
The ANC's break with the government means that the process of political reform that promised power sharing by the year's end has now been halted.
This dramatic decision of the ANC to cancel bilateral discussions is based on a fundamental untruth, namely that the government is involved in the killing of people.
But months later, another massacre, this time in Bisho, the capital of the Ciskei homeland. 28 protesters are shot dead. The country is a tinderbox, brittle, flammable. We fear it might explode into civil war at any moment. But every time talks fall apart, there's a reprieve. And so it is again. 2 weeks after the Bisho massacre, Mandela and de Klerk sign a record of understanding. Basically, it's a roadmap to democracy. But within the movement, people are worried. Is the ANC making too many compromises? Either way, the agreement catapults us forward. And once again, hope and dread walk hand in hand. One of the voices calming the frustration of young comrades is Chris Hani. Once the leader of Mkhonto weSizwe, he's now the head of the Communist Party, and Mandela likes him a lot. Comrade Chris has spent decades in exile, dodging bullets and surviving bomb attacks. The stories of the regime's failed attempts to kill him are legendary. Chris leaves a building, and 30 minutes later, it's bombed. Chris decides at the last minute not to go to a camp and narrowly evades an ambush. Now, he's back from exile, and he's one of those special people bridging the gap between moderates and radicals within the ANC. He's got that magic touch and a massive following. But on Easter weekend, 1993, the movement's heart is broken.
This is AM. I'm Hamish Robertson. Good morning. And we begin this morning in South Africa with the weekend assassination of top African National Congress official Chris Hani. He was also the Secretary General of the South African Communist Party.
Chris Hani has just pulled into his driveway and stepped out of his car when he's shot by a right-wing extremist. His teenage daughter, Kwezi, is standing at the front door and sees everything.
He was a hero to many of the young in the black townships. The killing is likely to have as big an impact on black consciousness as the death of Steve Biko in the late 1970s.
The country is in shock. Baba is devastated. We all are.
I knew Chris personally. We were actually friends and we had worked together for quite some time. But when he was killed, I am telling you, people were angry. People were angry. You were not certain what was going to happen.
Chris Hani, at 50 years of age, was a man many saw as the natural successor to Nelson Mandela.
Barbara Masekela is Nelson Mandela's chief of staff when she gets the call and has to break the news to Madiba.
It was unbelievable. You know, that at a time when we were discussing negotiations and things were so delicate, that suddenly there was the news that Chris had been killed. And so I called him.
So you phoned him to tell him about Chris Hani's assassination?
He couldn't believe it. He just said, Barbara, are you sure about this? Have you checked? It was just a moment when your mind is empty completely. It can't be that the freedom that we've waited for, because we all knew that the thing that we must stop is violence.
But violence is the thing that in this moment feels as if it will never stop. The news spreads like wildfire to where Union leader Zwelinzama Vavi is working in the Eastern Cape.
I remember I cried like a baby that day. The instinct was that we must go there and stone whites cars. The civil war in our view had started. This was the last straw.
I am not exaggerating when I say that after Chris Hani's murder, the future of South Africa hangs in the balance. Calls for revenge reach a crescendo. It's not clear if we'll make it across the finish line, if we will ever vote ourselves into a new peaceful order. How many more lives will this revolution take?
It took Nelson Mandela to calm the waters that night. Had he not arranged a live broadcast interview, the country would have gone into flames, I can tell you now. I mean, we were all ready to die.
President de Klerk and Nelson Mandela stand before the nation and address us.
Nelson Mandela announced that the person who killed Chris Hani has been arrested, and he says thanks to a white woman who saw this happening. People say Nelson Mandela became the president of South Africa that day.
It's genius. In a moment of unspeakable racial tension, Mandela thanks the white woman to remind his people not to lose sight of their humanity, not to exact revenge. Then he calls for calm. And it works. A date for South Africa's first free and fair democratic elections is set for the following year, the 27th of April, 1994.
The date for elections, 27 April 1994, was written in Chris Hani's blood. That's what we normally say. Oh, the excitement. Then we put up his posters everywhere. Nelson Mandela for president. ANC logo. Wow. Oh, it was like a wake me up, as Bishop Tutu will say. I'm dreaming.
It's worth jumping online and having a look at those election posters with Mandela's beaming face and the words, "The People's Choice." After decades of his image being banned, it's now plastered all over the country for everyone to see.
The first rally was in Nyanga, a black township area on the Cape Flats, and here Nelson Mandela was preaching to the converted, and he was preaching mainly in his native tongue of Xhosa.
There are times when the campaign is as joyous as Madiba's now familiar smile, but it never erases the anxiety. After Chris Hani's assassination, those right-wing Afrikaners are emboldened, even more aggressive, making threats, detonating bombs, showing up everywhere in full military gear. Kind of like toy soldiers. Just 6 weeks out from the election, the Afrikaner Resistance Movement, the AWB, sends men to Maputo, Tswana, to support a black puppet leader of the government who's trying to stave off an uprising. Black protesters are marching when suddenly the right-wingers start firing. But they aren't expecting what comes next. A black police officer takes out his rifle and shoots, picking off three white supremacists, one at a time. Journalists are covering the protests live on TV, and the killings are broadcast in real time across the nation. It's horrendous. And once again, we wonder, will this violence ever end? Will we make it to the election without a civil war? But miraculously, we do. On the 27th of April, 1994, I'm still at college in the US, but I am not missing my chance to vote. A bunch of us South African students jump in a van and drive 10 hours across two state lines to the closest polling station in Chicago. We have no money, so we sleep like sardines, packed in the van, and take turns driving. And when we get there, the office is open, and these Afrikaner officials, who yesterday were our enemies, are smiling at us, and they're ushering us in, and then we're stuffing our ballot papers into the boxes, and everyone is beaming and crying, and oh my goodness, we did it. We got there. I call home, and my family passes the phone around, and I talk to my mom and my sister and all the aunties and uncles and friends, and we are all giddy with joy. And then Baba gets on the line, and we are both in pieces. My wonderful, wonderful Baba, this is his day.
I always tell people that it's the most important day on the South African calendar ever. It was really the happiest day in my life. I mean, we had spent all our lives in exile, waiting for this day, and then it came.
Baba tells me he was in line to vote at 6 a.m., that he waited 4 hours to vote.
You must know this was the first time in our lives that we were going to put our name cross against the name, which made us take this, what do you say about your finger?
Oh yeah, the fingerprint.
The fingerprint, yeah.
Baba makes his mark in the box next to Nelson Mandela's face. He's voting for the African National Congress. after all this time.
You know, we're celebrating as if we had already won the election. But the fact that we had gone to vote was sufficient for us to say we've won. This is victory. And I think by the time the final announcement came, may have been in day three or day two, everybody knew that we had won, what they say, hands down.
Resoundingly.
South Africa elects more women to parliament than many other countries, 30%. And it's a progressive parliament. Abortion is legalized, the death penalty is abolished, and the interim constitution enshrines gay rights, including marriage equality, long before Australia. Our new constitution is a constitution for everyone. It's for white women who've lived in a super macho society, unable to push back against their husbands. It's for young people whose love across color lines was criminalized. We free ourselves as black people. But as Winnie Mandela says time and time again, through democracy, we free white people too. They are finally free to embrace their own humanity. So I'm proud. Just so, so proud. On the 10th of May, 1994, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela is sworn into office as the first president of a democratic South Africa. Words simply cannot describe that day.
In the shadow of a building that once housed white minority governments, the former prisoner took the highest oath of office.
I, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa.
I've looked forward for this day for many times, many a year. I was born in this apartheid era, and to shake it off, to me, is the greatest.
Nelson Mandela utters those words, never, never, and never again. The singing. You know Africans, when they are very happy, they sing.
And the ululation.
Yeah. Our kids will never, ever experience that. Never.
They won't, but we did. We did. What a time to be alive.
Now, the story I've been telling you ends here. But South Africa's story continues. And it's complicated. The road since that day has been both wonderful and rocky. Apartheid might officially be over, but its legacy will take decades to defeat. We're still working on it. I'm sure you hear lots of things about crime and violence and corruption in South Africa. But what you don't often hear about is our vibrant media, our heroic courts, and our enduring constitution, about how robust our democracy has proven to be. Oh, and if you don't know it, let me tell you, our music, it's still giving so much joy to the world. At the next election in 1999, the old man steps down, and we let him. It's time for Nelson Mandela to finally put up his feet. Madiba's long walk to freedom is over, but ours, it's only just begun. Boycott is produced on the lands of the Nalama, Gadigal, Darug, the Jarawarung, and the lands of the Wajak people of the Noongar Nation. Our series producer is Claudia Taranto. The script editor is Kirsty Melville. And our producers are Kathy Peters and Sarah Allerley. Our sound engineer is Matthew Sigley, and our editor is Michelle Rayner. Original music by Musa Diakate, performed by Musa and Patricia Alvarez. Thank you to Michael Nayland from ABC Archives, Ali Edwards, and Alison Wall from ABC Rights, Craig Tilmuth and Tim Jenkins. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and this has been a Rewind production for Radio National. And listen out soon for a bonus episode, how the apartheid sports boycott almost tore apart an Australian First Nations family. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.